kind of hard. I spent the time with him to try to get to know a little bit about him so I could crack a few jokes and introduce him to you. And I even spent time with him today, but the funny thing is, I guess with time you learn how to do this, but I told him my story. He didn't tell me his. And so, I don't know how that happens, but I'm going to keep coming back. So we get the opportunity to listen to him together, and I get to know him too. At this point, Josie, please.
Thank you, Derek. Bill Alcoholic. She wouldn't let me get a word in edgewise is what happened. You ever had that experience around here? I'd like to thank Sandy. She's been very kind. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Okay. I'd like to thank Bob, Mr. Twinkles Trimble, for inviting us up here. Where is he? Oh. Yeah, his sponsor is someone I know very well. And his sponsor's wife actually nicknamed Bob's wife Mrs. Twinkles. So he's Mr. Twinkles. If you guys don't call him that now, you can start. Because the couple times I called him that, he lowered his head and just cried, you know. So, Gary and Terry for driving us around. Gary, Terry's sitting right over here.
Nice.
You look incorrect by yourself back there. Men need supervision. I am an extremely well-supervised and monitored man. And, left to our own devices, we're pitiful. It's just pitiful. But I think I match. Do I match? That's so you know that I have a coat. This is very special for me to be up here this weekend. Back in the 60s, I was up here. We went to the Saturday fair, the Saturday market. What a blast from the past. That, I mean, it made me nervous. I bought a tie-dye Jimi Hendrix shirt, man. I had to. But my wife came up to me and she says, "You know, we're just too conservative looking for this place. You know, times have changed for us, but not here." And so, I mean, driving into town, it just was. It's a time warp, you know. It's just incredible. So it's really special to be up here. I've got a couple of kids up here, one of which is in the audience today. And it's just neat. It's neat to return to the scene of the crime and be sober and realize that people change. I never thought people changed. And you and I are lucky to be in an organization where we watch people's lives get saved every day. Every day. Lives get saved. Souls get saved. People get saved. We watch people change. It's incredible. And all the people, you know, Al-Anon is something that has meant a lot to me in my life. My father died in 1999, and when he died, he was 45 years sober. And my mother died just this last February, and she was 47 years in Al-Anon. And when I was 6 years old, a strange thing happened to my father. He got struck sober. Something happened to him, you know. Who knows what the hell that is? But most of us have experienced it. And I think it takes a little time. You have to be sober for a little while to look back and realize that how bizarre it is. I mean, it isn't anything that we decide to do. It's something that literally happens to us. And that's what happened to me. But when I was 6 years old, that happened to my father. And my mother went to the second meeting he ever went to. He came back from that meeting and he said, "There's something up with those people. I'm going back." So being a well-supervised and monitored man, she went with him for fear that he might make decisions on his own without input and guidance. And as it turned out, she ended up helping to found the L.A. Central Office for Al-Anon. She founded the inner group in Los Angeles. We're having our roundup this weekend in Torrance, California, where I'm from. We have a big roundup down there. And the Archives Committee is using some of her stuff. She's got letters from Lois Wilson, and you know, there was a lot. Back then in the mid-50s, there wasn't a lot of AA and Al-Anon. And on the West Coast, on this side of the country, we all kind of grew up independently from what was going on in Akron and New York. And my parents are literally part of that history, as are many other people. But they, it kept my family together. Al-Anon kept my family together. And it wasn't till I'm 50 years old, I look back and I could realize what happened. Why I had parents when I grew up. It wasn't because they loved each other so much. You know, because left to their own devices, if there hadn't have been AA and Al-Anon, I would have not grown up the way I grew up. So it means a lot to me. And my mother died in the living room of our house. And she was bedridden the last couple of months. She had cancer. And all of you were there. The Al-Anon army showed up, you know, made sure I was doing my job. And when my father died, they also surrounded my mother, and she got really back active again and going to meetings and stuff, because she was, you know, she'd lost her man. And what do we do when tragedy strikes in our lives? We have a place to go. We have a place to go when happiness strikes, too. But especially when tragedy happens, when something sad, so when something shakes us up. And but it's real special for me to come to these things. This is what my parents did a lot of, is what I'm doing as I stand before you right now. I can tell you, I can report to you, alcoholism runs in families. So does recovery. Recovery runs in families. And I'm a child of AA. I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up going to meetings, sitting in the kitchen, bringing out the coffee and the donuts, and holding hands with you, going, "Keep coming back, it works." And I don't recommend it. You know, it's like, it's pretty lame, you know. And my story is very much like Bill Wilson's story. Bill Wilson's story is that self-knowledge doesn't count for much as a treatment for alcoholism. And I grew up in a house where the big books were open. They weren't just coasters. These people actually read the thing. When you went on 12-step calls, it was before the hospitals had figured out how to make money out of this, so you brought them home. There was nowhere else to take them. And many times, I count the number of times that my father had to leave in the middle of the evening and he came back with some drunk guy. And he sat in the living room and pounded on the book and pointed his finger at him and told him the same lame-ass stuff we tell him today. Not much has changed, you know. Not much has changed. And I grew up in that kind of an environment. I'd come home and there'd be somebody on the back porch waiting for their sponsor to come home. You know, sometimes it was an Al-Anon person, sometimes it was an alcoholic. Sometimes they were drunk. We had a guy that became like a member of the family, a man named Harold Terrell. You know, my dad would give him work around the house to put money in his pocket. And he was always coming over, eating dinner, eating off of us. And he was around. He was like Uncle Harold. You know, I didn't know. It's like when you're a kid, you're in AA, you're not reading the book, you don't have a sponsor. I didn't know what was going on. You know, just all these people were constantly in and out of the house, you know. Phones ringing all the time. It was like, shit, I thought they had some kind of a sweatshop going on or something. You know, I didn't know. So this guy, Harold, he would be drunk, and he would be drunk, and he would be drunk, and finally he got sober, finally he cleaned up, and he was a cabinet maker, and he got a job, and then he met her on AA campus, and I went to the wedding. And then he got drunk, and then I was there at the divorce, and then he burned himself up alive in a hotel bed, smoking, drunk, and I went to his funeral. And when it was my turn to drink, I did it with a vengeance. You know, you remember waiting around for it? Remember when you were little, like, when are you going to score? You know, not just sipping your old man stuff, you know, like, when are we going to, let's go, how are we going to get that six pack? What are we going to do? And you go around, you hang around the liquor store, and you find the guy that's sleeping out back at the gas station. You give him $5, he comes back with a six pack, you know. I could remember waiting for when it was going to happen, plotting on it, waiting to get loaded, waiting to get high before I ever did. It looked good to me. I don't have much of a story, so I'm going to burden you with some opinions. My story is I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I looked good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat, primary chain for a belt, black greasy Levi's, big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. And I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. So like you, I was full of crap. You know? Isn't that true? Most alcoholics are just full of it. We're phonies. We don't even know it. We don't know it till after we get sober. You know? We don't have a clue. We're clueless. I think the truth is that when we started drinking, we stopped growing emotionally. So what's going on now is we get to grow up. And the chances of doing it when you're 40 years old and looking good are really slim. You know? I mean, you're going to look bad. You're going to say wrong stuff. You're going to treat people incorrectly. You're going to be scared to death and full of insecurity. You're going to get here and people are going to say things to you like, "You're not emotionally available for me." And you're going to stand there and look at them and you don't have an idea in hell what they're talking about. You know? You don't have a clue at all what they mean. What do they mean by that? What is she saying to me? Why does she keep saying that? Now, the truth about it is when they say that, there is this illusion that we have something that we are withholding from them. It's worse than they think. We don't even have it. It's not there. And maybe, if we're lucky, and we do some stuff, after 10 or 15 years, it might get there. So please, stop beating on us. It's an evolutionary thing. I'm a child of the 60s. I graduated from high school in 1965. And it was a... You too? You're not that old. Really? It was a great time to be getting loaded. It was the best decade we've had so far, I think. Every decade since... Every decade since has wanted to be the 60s. You know? I mean, look, tie-dye is back! And, that's right. Some places are still living the dream, yes. Gary explained that to me, actually, on the way in from the airport. But it was a great time. It was summertime all the time, and the road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was the road to Nirvana. Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe. They weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel. You know? The young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could. You know? We were trying to rise to the occasion. You know? It was just great, you know. I mean, you'll hear people say, "I wouldn't trade my best day drunk for my worst day sober." I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything. I mean, for what I remember of it, it was just really cool. I love the 60s. I'm sorry I missed it. You know, really. I ended up here in Eugene in 1967, I think it was. And I got married, I had a couple of kids, and I lost a family, and I lost that family to divorce, and I lost a house, and I lost a couple of cars, and I lost several jobs. And by the time I was 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution in Salem. Anybody else here been in the mental institution? Hey. Only those of us that have been in the mental institution know that it's not that bad. You know? You have some sparkling conversations in there. It is an eclectic crowd. It's a great place to look for a bride. My wife likes me to say after I say that I did not find her in the mental institution. But I did save her from a life of aimlessly wandering from man to man. No. Ooh. So remember the party? Remember the whole idea was to have a party. That was the whole idea, was to get out of the house. I wasn't drinking to retreat from anything. I wanted to get into things, get out of the house. And I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. What the hell happened to the party? The party didn't last very long for me by the time I was 22. You don't get in the mental institution because you had a bad week. You have to build up a toxicity level to actually qualify to get in there, you know. And, I was sticking needles in my arm every day and acting like a fool, running with the free souls up here. Are there any free souls here today? I was never actually a member of that club. I couldn't get my motorcycle to run. But I hung out with them a lot, you know. But you had to have a running motorcycle. Isn't that weird for a motorcycle club? I looked really good, you know. But I was a phony all my life. I was a pretend everything. At 22, I'm in the nut house. Lost a family. I needed you then. I needed you then. I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. But it wasn't for another 15 years before I got sober. And it was a tough 15 years. You know, when the party ends, why do we stay out there that extra 5 years or so? What the hell's all that about? You wouldn't want to leave just before the miracle? You know? Like, maybe they'll all line back up at the house, you know? Parties at Bill's house. But that didn't happen. We just stay out there. You don't need any other definition or explanation for alcoholism as a disease but that last 5 years. People that drink when there's no fun in it. And I was drinking, I drank for a long time, and there was no fun in it. I was drinking just to relieve the pain, just to not get sober, like our first speaker talked about. He talked about drinking so that I wouldn't be sober. The worst thing that could happen to me is that I'd be sober, that I have to sit there and look at me and deal with me without some cushion in between me and you. And I just drank. And by the time I was 37, I weighed over 300 pounds, and I was as miserable as I ever hoped to be. And there was no more designer dope. There was no more heroin or speed or acid. I couldn't even smoke pot anymore. That shit got really good. You know, they did something to that stuff, you know? Whatever happened to the old Mexican dirt weed? You could smoke five joints, you know? So I couldn't do that. It made me paranoid. It scared the hell out of me. All I could do was just me and a gin bottle. At the end, that's all it was. There was no more paisley stuff going on. You know? I do think there should be a separate program for all the acid heads, though, don't you think? That's kind of a special group, you know? I mean, the cocaine people got their thing. Why can't the acid people get theirs, you know? It's like, it adds a paisley tint to the drunk, you know? It gives you something to look at when you're puking in the toilet. So at 37, I went to my first psychiatrist, my first shrink when I was 13 years old because I hated my father. One of the requirements for being an alcoholic is that you must hate your parents. They're handy. And for the alcoholic life to seem like the only normal one, and we cannot differentiate the true from the false, it must therefore be someone else's fault. I can never, ever take responsibility for my actions. If I do, I can no longer continue to act that way. Therefore, it's your fault that I'm like this. And the first ones that come to mind are mom and dad. And I hated my father. I don't know that alcoholics know much about anger, but rage is an old buddy. You know, I can get high on rage. Sober, I can get high on rage. Just not a very few years ago, I got pulled over by a cop, and I was 14, 15 years sober. And I have a tendency to get these ticket things. And I informed this officer of the law that he had no right to insert himself into my life. I was perfectly capable of driving on my own. I did not need his guidance. Didn't he have something better to do? And he went back to his motorcycle, and I realized I'd made an error. And I thought to myself, how much longer am I going to continue to behave this way? How many times have you heard people at the podium say, I have a bit of a problem with authority? And they say that like it's a badge of honor. I'm here to report to you that is a character defect. You know, it's not anything to be proud of. Matter of fact, it's rather stupid, you know. And I had this moment of clarity. And I got out of my truck and walked back to his motorcycle, and he turned around and he looked at me and he put his hand on his gun and he said, get back in the car. And I had another moment of clarity. I said, one of these days, one of these guys is going to shoot me. And down at the Alano Club, they're going to say, what happened to Cleveland? Well, a cop shot him. And the other guy will say, well, that's understandable. He had a bit of a problem with authority. You know, and you'll talk to me about me for about a week or two, because that's about how much airtime you get. And but when I was 13, I manifested all this anger. I had fits of rage. I would slam doors, and I would bang my head into the headboard of my bed, and I just hated him. I can think back on it, and I could feel that visceral feeling of just hatred, anger. Oh, God, it was horrible. And my mother looked and said, there's something wrong with the boy, and sent me to a shrink. And this guy, I spent probably a year and a half, 2 years with him, and he helped me. I learned a lot about myself, and he helped me. Since that time, I've been in a mental institution a couple of times. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been observed. You ever been observed? You know, he's acting a little bit strangely. Let's put him on cell number 3 and keep an eye on him. You know, it's like been observed, and I've been shrunk by other individual psychiatrists. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screened. I know more about myself than is safe to know, actually. But it is my favorite subject, me. I can do me forever. You know, I find myself endlessly fascinating, you know. And so when it was time for me to get sober, I did the thing I knew to do. I figured I needed to get checked in somewhere, so I called Mom. No one loves you like your mother. And she came, the Al-Anon, came silently and gathered me up before I changed my mind and drove me to a recovery place in Costa Mesa called Starting Point. While I was in there, I spent 35 days in there. While I was in there, they made me wear a little sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. And it was a little piece of cardboard, a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string went over my neck, and I had to pour coffee for everybody in the morning because they said I had some kind of an ego problem. And what it said on the sign is, I am not a counselor. That and the earring are both true. But it was a pretty straight-ahead place. It kept me away from a drink or a drug for 35 days, and that hadn't happened to me since I was 15 years old. I spent over 20 years out there, and I've hurt myself pretty bad. I've got liver disease. I've got hepatitis C. It's a real problem. And I was in a second-story bar one time, got into a political discussion, and they threw me down the stairs. Another symptom of alcoholism is being correct and in the hospital. So at the time I walked with a pronounced limp. I had the muscles in my upper body had atrophied, and I had a pinched nerve in my right shoulder. My right arm was curled up against my side. I couldn't reach out to shake your hand. And I was as miserable as I ever hoped to be. But the arrogance of alcoholism is an incredible thing, isn't it? It's incredible. It has stamina. I mean, if you see a drunk laying in the gutter, if his eyes are open, you can bet he's got a plan. There's a plan. There's a plan. And, you know, I hid what little bit of dope I had in the house because I knew I'd need it when I got out of the hospital. You know, I had a plan. I didn't know. I could not imagine just walking into Alcoholics Anonymous and not drinking and going to the lame meetings. I couldn't imagine that. The last place I wanted to be was in my old man's club, you know, with you people. You know, that was the last place I wanted to be. Because children of alcoholics, when we end up in here in AA, you know what it means, don't you? We lost. We lost. And they're up at the house trying not to go to the meetings that we're going to, which is hard for them because they want to monitor us, you know? But what they're doing up at the house is they're going... That's what they're doing. That's what they're doing. Wondering who my sponsor is going to be, you know, trying to get me to the right guy, all that stuff. And so the last place I wanted to be was to admit defeat and come into AA. But this is it. There's nowhere else to go. When they're all done gestalting and rolfing and primal screaming, when all the insurance money runs out, we end up in the world's aftercare program, AA. There's nowhere else to go. It's metal folding chairs and linoleum floors for the rest of our natural lives. This is it. This is it. There's two very sad days in our lives. When alcohol stops working, that's a sad day. Because I believe for many of us it saved our lives for a long time. A lot of us have deep and profound emotional scars, and it helped us get through difficult times in our lives. And then all of a sudden, wouldn't you know it, it must be Satan, it becomes the problem. You know, the cure becomes the problem. The medicine becomes the problem. It turns on us. And the other sad day is when we end up at AA. AA! AA's not hip. Matter of fact, it's beyond lame. My friend Scott says, it's offered me a level of lameness that I did not know was available to me. I mean, the whole chip thing. I'd like to thank God and my sponsor for my sobriety. You know, the little chip thing. And then the coup de grace is, happy birthday to... I remember standing in my first meeting, standing in the back of the room, and you people were acting like that, and I was looking at my shoes. I couldn't look at you. I was embarrassed for you. You know? I remember driving home that day thinking, I can't do this. I'm too hip for this, man. I'm from the 60s, you know. You know, I'm pretty hip. And, you know, when you're fat, bald, and 40, and you're in your old man's club, that ain't very hip. You know, whatever happened to hip? Where the hell did the party go? How'd I end up with you? You know? After a while, I knew I had to get one of these sponsor things. Because everybody talks about it all the time, you know, and you're in the hospital program, they want to know who your sponsor is and all this stuff, you know. So I saw this guy and I walked up to him and I asked him to be my sponsor. And I thought they're just supposed to hold your hand and go, I'd love to, and we'll walk hand in hand off into the sunset, you know. And he said, be at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club at 8 o'clock. Meeting starts at 8:30 on Monday. Be there at 8 o'clock and we'll discuss it. I thought there was going to be a test, you know. But I showed up there, and he took me around the corner of the club, and he asked me a couple of questions. The first question he asked me was, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And if there's any new people here tonight, if you haven't been asked that question, I suggest to you that you just say yes, because you have no idea what they're talking about. It's a trick question. And if you say no, you got to listen to them for another 10 minutes or so, which can be really painful. You know? So I said, victory, that's what I want, you bet. You and me, buddy, victory. Uh-huh. Yeah. I figure I passed the first question, you know. No is not a valid answer for that. The second question he asked me was more of a statement than a question. He says, I noticed that when you identify yourself, you call yourself an alcoholic and an addict. I said, well, yeah, you know, I did a lot of dope. I'm from the 60s, you know. And they taught me to do that in the hospital. So what? And he looked at me. He's a short little guy. You know, he's like about that tall. He's 10 years younger than me. He's got a full head of hair, all of which pisses me off. And he says to me, well, I might suggest to you, if you're calling yourself an addict because you think it's a little hipper, slicker, and cooler, you might want to drop it and be like everybody else for the first time in your life. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can remember standing there in the dark, looking down at the little short guy. And I could feel that anger again. I could feel the bile from my stomach come up in my throat, and the burning in my throat, and the veins in my neck throb. That same hatred that I had for my father, that same problem with authority. And here was another one, pointing his finger at me, telling me how to believe. And what was going in my head was, who the hell do you think you are? And what came out of my mouth was, okay. Because this is it. This is it. There are no referrals from AA. This is your program. It's not mine. I've entered into your world. There's no debate. There's no argument. I can't change it. There's factions, I guess, you can fall into, and I didn't know that I'd fallen in with the right-wing death squad faction at Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I didn't. How was I to know? I figured this is what you were all doing. I didn't know that there were the kind of people that would say, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. Read the book. Call me when you need some help. This guy said, be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock. Read the doctor's opinion. Make notes in the margin about what you agree with and don't agree with, and we'll discuss it. I went to class. There was homework and everything. I didn't know. I didn't know there was an easier, softer way. I didn't know that there were people that never read the book and never work the steps and just go to meetings. I didn't know that. So I showed up. I did my homework like a good little boy. I was scared to death that nobody else wanted me. I wasn't wanted at home. They didn't want me at work. No one wanted. I didn't want to be anywhere, actually, either. I was scared to death. I'm standing there. I got naked blood now. There's no medication. It's just you right in front of me, and you're paying for it. It's awful not drinking. It hurts being sober. I walk into a room, you don't acknowledge me. It ruins my week. I'm new. I'm a raw nerve. So I did the homework, and I showed up at his house. He didn't trust me that I'd read it, so he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. He still didn't ask me my last name. He didn't pre-interview me. He didn't get like a feel for my case so that he could adjust himself accordingly to make this transition into sobriety a little smoother for me. I mean, the psychotherapeutic community was always interested in how I felt and what I thought about how I felt. I thought this was going to be the same thing. I'm here to report to you that AA is not therapy. This is not a self-help program. It's a spiritual program. You and I don't know anything about that. I don't have a clue. All I want to do is talk about me. That's it. I don't want to talk. He explained to me. He said, I'd be happy to sit and talk to you about what you think your problems are so that you will not share about them in the meetings. He actually said that to me. So we read the doctor's opinion, and in there it describes four or five different kinds of alcoholics, and he asked me, which one are you? So we talked about it, and I said, well, I think on this one here. He says, well, circle it, put a star next to it. You're in the book. Well, I kind of like that. And he explained to me, he said, this book is about you. It's not written to you. It's not trying to sell you anything. It's about you, and you should identify with it. If you don't, there's a problem, and you say you found yourself in the book, you're on the path. Cool. Now, in there, it also describes the only thing that's going to save an alcoholic of that variety is a complete psychic change. And we discussed that. We talked about the difference between a moment of clarity and a psychic change and really what it is. And he described his job as a sponsor and what he thought that job was. He says, my job is to help you, help bring about that psychic change, to guide you through the process of the 12 steps that will bring about a psychic change that will cause your perception of the world around you to change so that you will be comfortable in sobriety and maybe you won't drink anymore. Because it's not about not drinking anymore. That's already happened to you. Now we've got to figure out how you're going to live like that. Because if you don't do something about it, you will medicate yourself sooner or later. It might even take 20 years. But if you don't do something about it, if there isn't a psychic change, and my perception of the world around me should never ever be confused with reality. You know? I mean, the worst thing about my judgments and prejudices is they're incorrect. At least if you can be judgmental, it'd be nice if you were right once in a while. You know? But I make judgments and I have prejudices that are just askew. They're off the mark. Look at the pattern of relationships in our lives. Now, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is something to be survived. You won't keep me sober. Matter of fact, you're guaranteed to piss me off. Really? You'll borrow money from me and you won't pay me back. You'll hit on my wife. I'll give you a job, you'll do a lousy job, and somehow it'll be my fault. That's one of my personal favorites. You know? And then you won't show up to my birthday party after all I've done for you. I'm leaving the Alano Club one night heading for my car because you had pissed me off. 2-3 years sober, something like that. And I had another moment of clarity as I was heading for the car. And it was, where are you going, Bill? Where are you going to go? So I've got to figure out how to live with you. I've got to figure it out somehow. I mean, we love to mindlessly chant principles before personalities. What the hell does that mean? Where am I going to get some principles that are going to help me to survive your personality? I mean, this is the character defect center of the known universe. The absolute worst thing we do is relationships. Now, we do a lot of things poorly, but relationships is right up there. You know, we don't do them well. We're lousy employees. We're not good fathers. We're bad sisters and brothers. We don't make good lovers. We don't know a damn thing about intimacy. We think intimacy is sex, so we try to get as much as we can, you know. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is full of sexual predators. We don't know how. You ever watch people in AA? They go from one, next, and they're fixing themselves with people. It hurts. That hurts, living like that. Nobody's getting away with anything. So what am I going to do now? How am I going to survive this? What am I going to do about my relationship problems? That's the big issue, the big R word. How am I going to get along? So each week we got together with this man at his house and we read another chapter in the book and we worked the steps together. He guided me through the process of the 12 steps. The first step is pretty... You know, everybody talks about the path. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. Let me describe the path to you. The path is about 30 feet wide. It's light brown raked gravel. And on either side of it, to demarcate the end of it, are little white painted rocks. So you can see where the path goes. On the other side of the rocks is the jungle. Now, I'm real familiar with the jungle. I know where all the paths are, where all the watering holes are. I got my loincloth on, I got a quiver full of arrows and my bow, and I'm swinging through the trees. Time moves along, the loincloth's a little torn, all my arrows are gone, somebody ripped off my bow, and the lions and tigers are closing in. I am slowing down. So I come out of the jungle into this little meadow, and I see the path. It's real clear. Jungle, path. And there's only one. There isn't a different program for every person in AA. That was made up by an alcoholic that doesn't want to work the program. It's real clear. There are no omens that need to be deciphered. There is just the path. And I walk up and I look at it, and the path runs both ways, right? Well, it's real clear which way to go because there's a whole bunch of people going that way. So there's no confusion as to which way I go, so I step over the rocks and I'm on the path. Now, if you get on the path with us and you're walking along with us, it really helps if you keep up. Because if you slow down, people start bumping into you, and you know, it's just a real pain. Now, if you fall down, we will reach down and help you up, mostly to get you out of the way. But we will help. Now, some people do a strange thing. They step over the rocks, and they walk along the side of the path, not on the path, but in the little low brushy area just on the other side of the rocks. And it's not big, deep, ugly jungle, but there are tumbleweeds and potholes and stuff, and you kind of trip and fall, and you're stumbling along. And we look over there, and we say, "What's he doing over there with her?" Just because she steps over there doesn't mean he has to. But there he is. But we don't give it a lot of energy because we've all been over there. So you can run along there and you can move along, but you're not going to keep up. Now, some people wander off a little further out into the jungle, into an area where there's these little tall, small pole timber, like little birch trees. And now you're starting to really lose some ground because you're running into trees and the twigs are sticking you and stuff. And the people over in the birch trees do a funny thing. They pick up rocks, some of them, and throw it at the people on the path. So we line the newcomers up along the edge. Now, the people that are throwing the rocks, you can hear them say things. They say things like, "Well, you know, it's a cult, you know." Well, it is. I shaved my head. AA is a way of life. It's a cult. If you get in it, I mean in it, more than just going to meetings, if you get in it, it's kind of cultish. You know? I mean, we have our own little handshake and secret words and all kinds of stuff, you know. The other thing you hear them say is that, "Well, I'm going to get on with my life." You know? Like they've been as selfless as long as they can stand it, you know. You know, "I'm going to take care of myself now," you know, stuff like that. And then you can wander off past the birch trees where you go down into the valley and across the river into the deep, dark forest and the land of Mordor. And, you know, and some of you come back and we talk about arrows and Indians, and some of the reports are a little scary. "You know, it's not so bad out there. You got to come with me." You know, I suppose it happens. Maybe some people survive it, I don't know. But if you drank like I drank, I don't ever want to go back to the jungle. You know, I'm too old. I just don't have it in me. It hurt out there. It wasn't any fun. Working the steps is about 20% of the program. It's about 20%. And when we use the term working the steps, I think what most people mean by that is doing an inventory, making amends. It's been my experience in AA that most people in AA don't really do an inventory. Most people in AA don't really make the amends. I've been around long enough now for people to come up and say, will you work the steps with me?
And I'll say to them, well, haven't you done it before? And
he goes, not like what you're talking about. Not like that. I've not done that. I've written a little life story, and I said I was sorry to Mom. But you can find people in AA that'll tell you that you don't have to pay back the IRS. You can find people in AA that'll tell you that you don't have to pay back the dope dealers. You can find pretty much any opinion that you're looking for in AA. But I've found people in AA that are 8, 9 years sober. If there's people out there that have been sober some time and you don't feel connected, it's because you're not. There's no deep, dark psychological problem. You know, it isn't because that you're emotionally incapable of being connected. It's simply because you're not. Probably if you're feeling guilty, you probably are. You know? And if you want to rid yourself of those things, if I want to rid myself of those things, you'll notice that I speak for you a lot. I figure you're just like me. As a matter of fact, I know you are. You're just like me. And if what I'm saying to you out there right now pisses you off, listen up. It's probably touching a chord, because it's what happened to me. It's what happened to me. I had to pay back all the money. I had to go to Arizona and make amends to the woman that I forced myself on years before. And I pretended that, it doesn't matter. It didn't matter. Yes, it did. I got an awful lot of freedom from that. I had to fly up here to Oregon and make amends to my children and to my ex-wife. I had to find a doctor that saved this kid's life that's sitting in the audience right now, and I never paid the bill. And I found the doctor, and I went into his office. I brought him with me, showed the kid, and I paid the money back. My life changed. It changed my life. You can't take an alcoholic like this who the last person he wants to see is the person that he offended, the person he owed the money to. And I stand right before you and I look you right in the eye and I apologize for my behavior and I pay back the money. When I turn away from that moment and I step away, I have changed. It'll change me. I will never, ever change by thinking my way through it or by analyzing it. Nothing will happen. I will understand it better, but I will not change. Psychotherapy could be a very, very helpful thing. As a treatment for alcoholism, as a freedom from the bondage that I have in myself, it hasn't helped me at all. If I'm going to go do it, I should be very careful of it, because psychotherapy reestablishes self. It allows me to believe that I can fix myself. What you have taught me, what my sponsor taught me, what this spiritual program taught me, is that the solution to my problems is the absolute opposite of that. The antithesis of it. The other side of the spectrum. If you ever catch yourself alone in a room thinking about your problems, get the hell out of the room. Go find someone else and help them think about theirs. You know? What AA has taught me, and what Bill and Bob learned from the Oxford group, is to help others. 80% of the program is working with other people. That's the 80% of the program. You want to work? You ever heard people say, I'm stuck on the sixth step? Where? Where are you stuck? You know, I'm stuck on the third step. I have a problem with God. Well, of course you do. You're an alcoholic. You have to have a problem with God. It's mandatory that you have a problem with God. If you don't have a problem with God, you need a different sponsor than me, because I still have a problem with God. Let's pray. What do you say? Well, I can't pray. Well, then meditate. Oh. Well, you're stuck on the sixth step. I'm not going to fix my character defects. You know how my character defects are going to get addressed? You're going to show them to me. This fellowship that I have to survive, me getting in with you, becoming part of you, so that you can no longer hurt me. The God within me is the same God that's within you. I can know that today. I know that. I know that. On a good day, I'm there. I understand that at depth. Because you've invited me into your life. When your children are born, when your children are dying, when your parents are dying, when my parents are dying. I've been there with you. You've been there with me. We've shared these experiences together. I have intimacy today. I am close to you, heart to heart. If I have a prejudice, and I'm involved in AA, and I'm out actively trying to help others, I'm out looking for people that I can help, if I have a prejudice, it will be sent to me.
If I have a prejudice against homosexual people, black people, Mexicans, Oregonians, you will be sent to me. Guaranteed. You know. And what I'll learn from that is, I have no clue who you are. I have no clue. I don't know who you are. I'm looking at you across the room and I've already pigeonholed and categorized you. Oh, he's one of those. And then you'll come walking across the room and I go, oh shit, here he comes. Sure as hell. And he'll say, will you be my sponsor? And I'll say, oh, of course I will. You gotta be happy to, you know. Are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over God? And you'll sit in my living room with me. We'll read the book just the way that man read the book with me. And we'll read the book and I will learn about you. You will tell me your story. And I will connect with you. I will connect. Ultimately, maybe it'll take a while, but I will connect. That incomprehensible demoralization, I will connect. Now, I've stood at podiums and I've said that if you're taking medication, if you're taking Prozac or something like that, you're not sober. I've said that at a podium, at podiums before. You know why I said that? Because I heard you say it. And I want to be like you. I want to be a hard ass. I want to be a right wing death squad AA guy. You know, I want to be able to define sobriety, and it's black and it's white, and I've said that. Then a guy came up to me and he said, will you be my sponsor? I said, sure. And as we're going along, I realized that there is something severely wrong with this guy. He has this bipolar thing. Not the pretend kind of bipolar thing that newcomers have because they're jerking and twitching because they don't have any drugs in them. You know? But I mean the real kind of bipolar thing that when you're totally detoxed, you're weird still. You know? And you're high and you're low. And I've had to peel this guy off the ceiling and lift him up off the floor. Now when I see him come and I say to him, have you taken your medication? Because you're sick, man. So I had an opinion. Then I had an experience. And it changed my opinion. I had a prejudice. I had a judgment that I knew nothing about. And this guy came into my life. One night he curled up in my lap like a little boy, just cried, sobbed in my shirt. He's a grown man. And he was just devastated. I mean, there are demons around here that we just have no clue about. I did this little rant one time about sponsoring people. You don't ever say no. You don't get to fire them, ever. You can't fire them. You don't have to, really, because they'll just wander off. You know? If you keep telling them stuff they don't want to hear, they'll get rid of you. You don't ever have to fire them to teach them a lesson or something, you know? I don't think that's right. I think that's incorrect. I think there's rules, you know? I'm a little opinionated, you know? And this woman came up to me. She says, you know, a girl came up and asked me to sponsor her, and she's a cocaine addict. And I told her no, because I've never had any experience with cocaine. What do you think about that? And I told her, I said, well, you know, you never will have any experience with cocaine now because God sent this woman to you to show you about it, and you just rejected her. I don't get to ever say no. It isn't up to me to determine whether you're correctly alcoholic enough for me to work with. I have no clue how God is going to use me. And I am the instrument of God's will. I am how God works in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am the one. I am my own little Jesus. I am carrying the word. I am out there. Is that arrogant? Does that have a tinge of arrogance about it? Get some. We were saved for a reason, you know. There's a reason we were saved. If we don't speak the words, they won't hear the words. If we don't drive them in our car, they won't get to the meeting. If we don't take care of them, if we don't feed them, they won't eat. People say when somebody new comes in and he goes out, they say, he wasn't ready. Well, are we ready for them? Are we ready? You ever heard people say, the longer I'm in AA, the less I know? Don't you wonder about those people? Aren't they paying attention? I know a hell of a lot about living sober. I've had some major life experience. I've been sober for a long time. I've read the book God knows how many times. I've worked with all kinds of different people. I'm a much better sponsor today than I was before. Bill Wilson says some powerful things in the book. He says that it takes a message that has depth and weight to help the alcoholic. Depth and weight. Do I have a message that has depth and weight? Do I understand where I am, what I'm doing, and why I'm doing it? After the ninth step, he says another even more powerful thing. He says, it is now time to increase in understanding and effectiveness. I do not think that's the longer I'm sober, the less I know. I think what he's talking about is you've made some amends. You've written an inventory. You've taken a stock and trade. You've cleaned up the past. You've got some kind of a meditation prayer routine that you're doing. And you've gone through the trial by fire. Now go save the brothers and sisters. Go get them. That's what we do. They can't reach out to us. They can't reach out to us. We tell them all the time, you have to reach out. They can't. They're scared to death. They're scared to death. The ones that can reach out, I'm a little worried about them. You know? But it's my job to pay attention to who's in the room, to walk up to my meeting and look around and see who's there, what's going on. 80% of the problem is working with others. 80%. I will see myself through your eyes. You will show me things. I will learn more about me than I will ever learn on my own. You will invite me into parts of your life where I don't want to go, where I'm scared. You leave me up to my own. I'm a shallow guy. I'm a shallow guy. You know, I mean, on a good day, I think about tits and beer. You know? I mean, that's it. I'm a drag racer. I'm a drag race cars. I'm a drag racer. They don't even allow me to turn. I can only go straight. You know? Now, if I say yes or no to what I will and won't do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will never do anything that causes me to be uncomfortable. Why would I? I'm a human being. I want to feel good all the time. All the time. I never want to be uncomfortable. If I walk into AA, into your world, and I go into your world, why would I say no? Why would I stop God from coming to me? That's how He comes to me. He sends somebody that asks me to go somewhere. Sends somebody to say, Bill, you got to go to Eugene now. Some guy walks up and says, will you read the book with me? Says, will you go on a panel? Why would I say no? How do I know where I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to do, if I start deciding what I will and won't do? I'm in your world now. I should just go to have a different experience. Push the envelope. Step out of the box, out of the shallow box. If I want to develop a heart and get a God in my life, I've got to let Him come. I've got to let Him in. How could I possibly say no? You ever heard people in AA say, I don't sponsor people. There's too much ego in it. Please! Spiritual pride. Arrogance. You know, my job is to be here for you. My job is to sponsor you, or to be your friend, to help you, to allow you to come on with me. You want to get sober? You want to see how I live? Come to my house. Follow me around. That's what I did with my sponsor. I followed him around. How else would I learn how to live? He had something I wanted, but I don't have any clue what it is. When they say that, what do they mean about that? What is all that about? Do you want what I have? What is it I have? What is it I have? I've had the experience of sitting across the table from a guy and I see the light come on in his eyes. The light is hope. Remember that day? Remember the day? Remember the day you were sitting here and it suddenly hit you? Maybe this is going to work for me. That happened to me in that man's living room as he was talking to me. Suddenly, for some reason, I knew he was telling me the truth. This was the truth. Had I ever heard it before? I don't know. But I knew I was hearing it then. And it hit me. This is going to work for me. I think maybe I'll be okay. Maybe I'll live. Maybe I'll have a life. Maybe there'll be love in my life. Maybe I'll be able to open my heart up and let you in. Maybe I'll be able to feel that peace that passes all understanding. Maybe that'll happen for me. Maybe. I'd like to close with something that really is very dear to me. And I should have memorized it by now, but I have brain damage, and I just can't seem to. Nothing stays. I don't know what that's all about. Too much reefer, I think. And this was written by a man by the name of Sam Shoemaker. Sam Shoemaker was the pastor at Calvary Church. When Ebby Thatcher came to Bill Wilson, Bill knew that whatever happened to Ebby really worked because Ebby was 60 days sober. That's all he needed to know. You know, it didn't really impress Bill Wilson because Ebby had 10 years sober. You know, that doesn't have any impact on people. I think when somebody doesn't drink for a month or two, that's a pretty major achievement when you can't not drink. And Ebby told Bill, "I've got religion." And Bill went, "Oh my God, it's come to this. It's like me walking into AA. Oh, geez, no." But that night, Wilson went looking for Ebby, and he went looking for him where he knew Ebby would be, and that was at Calvary Church in New York City. Sam Shoemaker was the pastor there, and Wilson wanted to know what Ebby had. And on the way, he met a new best friend who was a Swedish sailor, and they got shit-faced. And they showed up at the door of Calvary Church drunk. And Ebby came and says, "Okay, you can let him in. This is Bill. He's a friend of mine." And Wilson, that night, gave himself to Jesus on the podium. The next morning, he was so embarrassed, he entered Towns Hospital, and he never drank again. You know, he woke up, he was devastated. You know, my God, because he's this hip stockbroker dude, man, you know. I mean, he's from the 60s, you know. And, you know, this is just too lame. You don't do stuff like that. And what happened in the ensuing years is that Wilson became involved in the Oxford group. That's who Ebby got in. That's who sobered Bill up. Or Ebby up was people in the Oxford group, a man named Roland Hazard. And Wilson became involved in that. He became part of the businessman's group of the Oxford group. When he went to Akron, Ohio, and the business deal went south, and he called and found Dr. Bob, he called a person in the Oxford group, and Bob was in the Oxford group. That man's, Bob's wife, well, it was actually another woman, called Bob's wife and said, "He's here, the one that we've prayed about." It just chokes me up. And they found each other. And here we are. Now, what did these men teach these two guys? What did they teach them? What did these Oxford group people teach them? Save the brothers and sisters. Save them. Go get them. Go find someone with a problem like yours and help them. Give testimony. They had house parties where they shared. They did it one day at a time. They talked about God as you understand God. This all came from the Oxford group. If you're 3 or 4 years sober out there and you're working on your third or fourth inventory, throw it away. You've missed the point. It's not about inventory after inventory after inventory. That endless procession of me, me, me. That bottomless pit of self-pity. Because I never end. It never stops. It never goes away. I am an endless morass of goddamn problems. It just never... And I finally get relief from the bottomless pit of me. Finally, I don't have to do it anymore. I don't have to work on me anymore. All I have to do is work on you. That's all I have to do. And I'll be fine. I'll be okay. Sam Shoemaker wrote this poem. And I believe it is the heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe it's who we are and why we're here. And this is a synopsis. It's only part of it, but it means a lot to me. And it's called, "I Stand by the Door." I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There is no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched, groping hands, searching for a door, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter. Die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they've not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find Him. So we stand by the door. Thank you.